Now, here in Philadelphia, we are just one of, it looks like we have a new one. It's 28 or 29 other lodges that are situated throughout the world. They all do their part at their meetings and their classes of spread broadcasting the teachings of philosophy and the philosophy of theosophy. We too do our share by meeting twice weekly. Of course, we are all here on Sunday, so we know we have Sunday classes. The doors open at 10:30. Classes start promptly at 11, and it's over at noon. We are now in the second month, that being of February, and we are dealing with discussions during this month of the care of the soul. Coming next week, next Sunday, the 15th, we will be talking about good food for thoughts. And of course, today we'll be doing the strengthening and purifying feelings. Also, on Wednesdays, we have our study class, and we are currently studying in The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. Those classes start at 7:30, and they're over at 8:30. But also on Wednesday night is our reference library, which is open from 5:15 to 7:15. There's usually some selection that has been made of some sort of reference to the class of that night. That's available, plus we have a vast collection of many different topics within the library, and there's always someone there to help you with any reference you might be wanting to look up. So, being with those in mind, that takes care of our meetings. And as was stated, the main purpose of any lodge, beside having the association of students to be able to be there, is the fact that they all have a declaration that they can stand by as the basis for the reason for the study of the philosophy. And we would like to read that at this time. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles. Through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophy belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So we will continue now, end with our meeting for today. The subject matter, as we stated, does have a strong dealing with the care of the soul. That being that the strengthening and the purifying of our feelings. So we will now have a short talk, and then we'll have a time period for questions and answers and comments on the subject.
Good morning. Today's subject, strengthening and purifying feelings. The first thing that we have to do is we have to establish what is meant when the word feelings is used in a theosophical term. Theosophy says that man and nature is septenary in its makeup. That is to say, there's seven parts. Of those seven parts, the last two, or the highest two, Atma and Buddhi. Of those two, Buddhi is the receptacle, the home, and the residence of our feelings. These feelings consist of experiences that we have had in this life and in previous lives. Not all experiences become feelings. They are distilled. Those which pertain to our higher self, to our spiritual self, to the highest and most noblest ideals that we carry within ourselves, reside in Buddhi. Those which are pertaining to the maintenance and development and care of this physical self dissipate. So this is what we are speaking of when we say feelings. Now, in feelings, in that Buddhi nature, feelings has the ability to nourish the pilgrim on his travel, on his travels, on his path. And it nourishes him by being that small voice that whispers in his ear in times of turmoil, in times of trouble, in times of really tough decisions. That small voice that you hear, we call it conscience, but that's a feeling. And they come about through past experiences of the incarnating monad into the body. So we have an idea now of what we are speaking of, a feelings. So let's look at strengthening and purifying feelings. For those of us who really require and desire technical expertise in these subjects, there's a lot of them. You can ask me. I can give you a host of books that you can look at and go through, finding out all of the technical particulars to deal with Buddhi, manas, the makeup of man, and there's a lot of it. But this morning, for our purposes, being babes in this study, let's try and break it down to the most simplest terms possible. And I didn't come to this until last night, sleep bringing my eyes tired. Basically, what it really boils down to is choices. The choices that we make. That's how we strengthen and purify our feelings. This is what that means. That well, that of patterns that we create in each lifetime, that in succeeding lifetimes we go back to for nourishment and refreshment and upliftment. that pattern can be, I don't want to say manipulated, but constructed of the best of our ability by making the best choices we can. And we always have. See, once the monad comes to life in this body, incarnates in this body, it is like if someone was to take you, to hit you in the head, you have amnesia, they take you to a foreign land and drop you on the shore and leave you. You are a slave to your surroundings. You do whatever it takes to survive without understanding the language, without understanding exactly where you are, but you have that will to survive and you'll serve that. And that will be the choices that you make. And that is the condition that we usually find ourselves early on, and, well, not early on, but in our lives. Early on, we are, as HQB said, our first taste of consciousness awakens in us a love for justice, a love for humanity, a love for compassion, a desire to do the right thing. You watch children in the playground and you'll see this. It's exhibited all the time. You'll see children sharing their cookies or their lollipops or their candy, sometimes to the consternation of their parents. You know, take it out of my mouth and put it in this kid's mouth. He's got a cold. We don't know. We don't care. That's the way children are. And that is the exact example of our oneness with each other, that desire not to see differences but to see the likelinesses of it. So that's how we're born. But as we grow, we start becoming more compartmentalized. We become separated. We become, oh, he's over there, I'm over here, I have this to do, he has that to do. We start becoming more exclusive instead of inclusive. When this happens, this is when we need to really start thinking about the choices that we're making. This is when our deeds, our experiences begin to build patterns in our booty, patterns that we need to nourish us, not only in this life, but in lives to come. This is the strengthening. This is the purifying of our feelings. We have the opportunity, the chance, to build whatever we want and to build it any way we want if we really seek for the higher, if we really put ourselves in that position. And it's difficult, it's not easy, because once the monad comes to in this body and becomes, as we say, you know, we have to be attentive with it. It's our responsibility to take care of it. But once he does, he is put in the position of serving two masters. And you can only be true to one. So this care, the sensual pleasure, I don't want anything to hurt, I want everything to feel good. That's what happens with this body. But if you read, and there, like I said earlier, there are so many books on this subject, the Bhagavad Gita, the Voice of the Silence. Every great writer has addressed this problem of the soul, of the monad and the body, and the choices between the two masters that he has set before. Now I've lost my place, but give me a minute. But the two masters that he has set before, choosing the two between the two is not as, it's difficult, but not as difficult as you choose. You know, when you think in terms of eating, just in terms of eating, the body requires nourishment. You get a feeling that you need food and you feed the body. But that same impulse, that same desire, if I need to eat, what of all these other people that need to eat? So another impulse comes. Not an impulse to eat, but an impulse to feed others, to help others to eat, to help others to nourish themselves. One is the higher and one is the lower. Balanced on a fulcrum. We can take it either way we want to. I'm going to read just a quote, very short quote from Lao Tzu. great acts are made up of small deeds. There's a great clue in that. Great acts are made up of small deeds. Many of us are looking for this life-turning decision that we'll make and everything will be okay and we'll be the hero and carry it out on the, you know, on the shoulders of our comrades through that one deed. But the truth of the matter is, every day you make choices that affect who and what you are and what this world is. Not big choices, small choices. Sometimes that you don't even pay attention to. And that is what this address this morning is saying. Wake up. There are no small choices. Mm-hmm. They're all big choices. They all strengthen or weaken, purify or muddy our feelings. Thank you.
So let's look at some of those ideas. Our feelings. For the majority of people, when we say our feelings, we're speaking about the personal part of our nature, the temporary, shall we say, part of our nature, the everyday feelings, and yet where did they all come from, you know? Why are some so deeply embedded within us, certain feelings? And then there's some that we could care less that they entered into our mind. So if we use the idea that these come from and they're effects of mental deposits that we've made in previous lives, if it is a strong motivating feeling, it didn't just come this one time. And so if we use that idea, maybe we can decide the point that was brought up, the idea of choices. How do we choose to think? How do we choose to act? That's an important part of our nature, an important part of the temporary nature, and also of our permanent part of our nature. How do we take care of ourselves, the souls? Yes.
The concluding statement in the presentation, there are no small choices, puts one in mind of Mr. Judge's warning that we're all waiting, as was said in the talk, for this important event, and we'll make the right choice then. And his warning is, if you don't make the right small choices, you will never be prepared to make the right big one.
And if you think about it, it makes common sense. You know, if you start small and build up a routine, a habit, a way of thinking, a way of feeling, we are thinkers. That's what we do. We think. Sometimes we think correctly. Sometimes we think incorrectly. Sometimes we think high. Sometimes we think low, sometimes we think personal, and sometimes we have a feeling of selflessness. So where does a balance come? Yes.
Why is it that after we've gone through tremendous difficulty, pain, suffering, we seem to come out of it with a higher feeling than we had before? It seems to have almost a cleansing.
That feeling that we get after the situation is over with. Is it a feeling of peace, of calmness, of contentment? It would seem it's like something's been lifted within us. Something has left, and we are left with this contentment feeling, this balance feeling. It would seem that could be a situation that would fall into that. Yes?
Sometimes those situations that we experience that are tough to get through have the a certain way so that the effect is that the permanent endures, but the temporary, that much more the temporary is gone.
And we need to put a balancing sheet on this idea of that which is enduring and that which is temporary. Why would you put all one's energy on something that is temporary versus something that is everlasting and permanent? If we're going to have building blocks, wouldn't it make more sense to put more energy out towards something that is everlasting, ever being? Way in the back.
We think part of what's behind both choices is desire and motive. So the only way we're going to continually make the better choice is to check our desires and check our motives, because that fuels this whole process. Behind will stands desire. Behind that is the original thought, and the end of that is the action. So we need to check, as I said, check ourselves and see where it really began.
It is a study, a strengthening and purifying something. Just in the general terms, it's going to take some work. And it's not the type of thing that you can check every so often. It's got to become routine, because for so long and so many lifetimes, it seems for most people, we get enamored with the costume we wear and all the makings that come with it that have been choices and decisions that were made in the past. And there's just so much in one lifetime that can be expressed. So it has to be an ongoing type thing. We have to sort of turn down the volume on the radio, turn down all the outside effects, and start to really listen to that consciousness that was mentioned also in the talk. Because that's a very keen part. That consciousness is coming from a permanent nature, not a temporary nature. Yes.
We think one of the important things that Theosophy teaches you is that the feeling that you bring to an audience, to a conversation with someone, that that feeling is felt by the other. And if your feeling is negative or unpleasant, they have to overcome that. So the important realization that you yourself are responsible for what's going on within you and around you and how you influence others.
And that's a very interesting point when you think about it, and also important. How things that affect you, that come to you directly, and how they affect you, could be a balance sheet that we could use, because it's not, oh, whoa, poor, miserable me. Why is this always happening to me? That's not the situation. If we look at the idea that if you put something into motion, it's eventually going to fizzle out. But if you put something into motion and work on it, and keep it moving, we are strengthening it. And by that, we can say there is no poor, miserable me in any one of us. We're here to learn. Life is a school. It is a school of learning. And if, in fact, we have been incarnating for such a long period of time, we have possibly accumulated a lot of unbalanced situations that we're going to have to see over and over again until we learn what is the correct way to do something. Yes?
Well, when we think of feelings, we immediately think of our personality, because that's usually what gets hurt or is wounded or what strikes back. How is it suggested that we rise above that personal idea so that we're not so affected by this personal nature?
That could be many lifetimes a job to be had. But basically, if we could take parts of our nature that we know are of a calming part of our nature and really just look at things the way they really are, not so much feeling for the effect it makes us feel, but to look at the situation and really what it is. Is it life-threatening? And if it is, does that matter? If it's something that's going to influence the way I would interact with others, how important is that? If we want to be of a universal idea, of that idea of brotherhood that does exist, that if we look past the outer limits, we all know there are certain feelings we can all express. And then there are feelings that we don't need to express, and yet the personal is like crying out for that feeling. And usually it's a negative feeling when you think about it. It's something that's been put upon us. Whereas if we just looked at it as something that we must experience and work through, from that thought comes that act. From that act will come the reaction. So if we look at it that way, rather than taking our building blocks and making them a hindrance for us to get by, we could make it something we could work on and build to. Yes. You in the back.
Oh, we were thinking about that point this morning. We are definitely generalized, I guess is the word, to think certain ways. And we were thinking of examples. Let's say we're walking down the street in the evening and a bunch of teenagers is walking towards us. Our first thought may be, I'm in trouble. They may be coming home from choir practice. You never know. So it's a matter of ascribing the highest circumstance that you can. You know, you see somebody struggling to cross the street, but you're late for a meeting, go help them. That 30 seconds is much more important than you looking good getting to the meeting early or whatever it might be. So it's changing our thoughts when we see people. If they don't look right, well, maybe they're ill. You know, what can I do to help?
Hmm. And as we say, that right there is a negative standing. The philosophy and all ancient Eastern philosophy teaches that there is a pure way of living and there is a non-pure way of living. And you cannot really dabble in the two, a little of this, a little of that. You've got to make a choice, make a decision how you're going to want to live. Do you want to live in something that's more harmonious, more balanced, more an outgiving rather than what's it coming to me attitude? It just seems it would be a lot less work and tension on an individual. Yes, from the back.
Interesting thing about this idea is often we hear people say they do good, which is to be respected, but the truth of the matter, the construction that you're trying to build in doesn't do good. It is good. It is the embodiment of good, which is what you are overall striving to be, not to just do good, but to your identifying quality and your very makeup and your nature and your very heart to be good, not just to do good, because if you can do good, you can also do bad. But you can't do bad if you are good.
That's a good point to work on. Yes, because we were just thinking when you said that, it's a type of thing that it's more important to ourselves within than us expressing to everyone. Look what I did. It's just a contentment that you know inside that you've worked on something that you can honestly say, I feel it's finished, it's done. There will come a point that we will all, if we take the energy and effort in each lifetime to work on our defects, to clean up our doorstep, shall we say, so that we can move on to other doorways. Yes.
Who or what is the feeler?
Who or what is the feeler? This is very interesting. Depending, we would think, on the feeling would have a lot to have something to do with it. There is a part of our nature that we can honestly say we have at some time in our lifetime acknowledged it exists. It's a feeling we have. There's got to be something more than just this. Where does that come from? What part of our inner nature knows this is something that is now, has been, and will be again? It's a whole continuance of cycles that we have to understand. We are literally moving through these cycles. We are moving through to hopefully gain lessons by going through situations due to the choices we make now and the choices we have made before. But there is a part of our inner nature that knows there is something more than we see right now.
Going back, taking what you just said, and going back to the question about the personal, if we were our personal nature, how many times have we died? Think about the feelings you had as a teenager. Where are they?
Gone.
You outgrew them, you altered them, and you continued looking at your life that way. What happened to that personal nature? It's constantly in flux. Well, then who is in charge? Who is really making choices? Are we letting the personal run away with us and we're just watching? Or are we trying to be in charge? So we think we have to remember the real chooser is always the thinker, even if what we're choosing is the habit of the personal that we're used to.
And as being thinkers, the other thing that comes with it, of all the kingdoms on this planet, we are the, shall we say, the key, because we have the power of self-consciousness. We have the power to make choices. All the other kingdoms do not make choices on a balancing point. They work under natural impulses. And in a way, some of that, if we look to nature, is of a higher intelligence than some of us express in our daily life. Yes.
But everything seems to come from our desire nature, that we desire, what we desire is what we usually get. Maybe we don't get it when we want it, but if we have a desire to love people, if we have a desire to, as Buddha taught, to be, what's the word, Buddha nature, is in love with the world, in love with life.
The compassion.
Compassion, thank you. And, you know, if we don't have that desire, we can't do anything. If you don't have a desire to get up in the morning, we won't be maybe linger in bed all day. Or if you don't have a desire to help someone, or if you don't have this. So desire seems to stand behind all of this.
Again, our use of desire. If someone like the Buddha could live the life they did, do you not think that was of some sort of desire? There are higher desires, and there are more lower desires, temporary desires for just the now, what you want. But then there are desires that never really stop in a way, because it's a way of living. It's a way of thinking. And they tell us it doesn't matter how many times we slip and fall. If we've got the gumption to get up and just keep trying, eventually we're going to hit the point that we need to hit that will make us understand how we choose and what we choose and why we choose something. Again, there is the temporary in us, that personality. This personality that we look in the mirror and see, this is only here this time. There might be aspects of it that might move on to other lifetimes, but it's a temporary housing. It's a costume that we wear. And yet, we give so much to it. We clothe it, we feed it, we glamorize it, we humorize it. It's again, we think of the idea of balance. Why put all this energy into something that's only here once, when I can take all the knowledge that's within me that I, the true I, have gained through many lifetimes of many experiences, and be able to express it, and in any one lifetime have that desire to express it, is how you come up with a Buddha, a Lao Tzu, a Jesus. It had to have been a desire that we really wanted to work on something that was everlasting. Something worthwhile, not just to ourselves, but to all mankind, to all the kingdoms in the universe.
One of our most enjoyable activities early in the morning after getting up is go to the window and look out in the backyard. First thing we do is grab our heart. And we notice that others do the same thing in different situations. They may not grab their heart like we said we did. So there must be a common sense in the possession of all creatures. And that man, the intellect and the heart, are supposed to be linked in a common sense. And we often express, in fact, next Friday, on the 14th of February, everybody is supposed to be expressing that common sense. But it's our feeling that it has to be a connection between that common sense and the way we think. So could you explain the relationship of heart and mind, and tie it in and say it's a common sense held by all?
How often do we express a gratitude to nature, a gratitude to situations, a gratitude that we are alive and walking and well, if we're in that situation? But the idea of expressing a gratitude where situations look very slim, but because of a few, the slimness is slowly falling away, and other individuals are pulling together and climbing up also. Then it's a larger mass of individuals who are thinking and expressing in a nature that would be truly a show of gratitude, of life in general, of being able to think on different levels, having the ability to live on different levels, whether one lives in poverty or lives in riches. It's how they use the situation and how they use it towards others that make a big difference, we are told. Yes.
That idea of gratitude, we usually tie gratitude to the idea of some reward or something we think of as beneficial and pleasant. But certain individuals have expressed or shown us that we should also express gratitude even for the bumps that life brings to us. Because if we see life in our incarnations as a schoolroom, these are nothing but lessons to be learned. Even our illnesses often point to some great lesson that we can get from it. There was a movie out, in fact, I think it might still be, I know it's still available, about a gentleman living in Texas, the Something Buyers Club, who was a drunk, a bully, a thief, just a really low-life guy, and he contracted AIDS. And AIDS actually helped him, actually made him more of a human being than he was when he was well. It became beneficial to the makeup of it, to his makeup. It enhanced his personality. It made him a different person. So it's difficult for us to see, how could you be thankful for that? How could you be have gratitude for that? Mm. But it's these different experiences that actually help us to grow. Winning the race isn't always the best thing for us. Coming in number two sometimes gives us a really beautiful lesson.
That's true. Yes, you had a point back there. You. Didn't you? Oh, back in the back.
Well, we were thinking we don't need to wait for a particular day that society says is the day we express affection or gratitude. Even a smile at someone is a measure of gratitude. It's mm-hmm. saying, I'm glad you're in my life, I'm glad you're in front of me. And if we bring that attitude to everything, even when we stumble, because it's too painful or it's too difficult, if we bring that smiling attitude, we're going to learn something from it, and that does affect our feelings.
Now, we were just thinking, there's another point that we haven't really touched on, but it sure has a lot to do with how we think and where we think. Fear. Fear is a great motivator for most all of us. But then, once we find out what the situation is and we see it for what it really is, there's no longer fear there. We can take our fears that we worry mostly about what other people think of us. My goodness, we're the ones that really have to live with ourselves. If we should have any fear, we should fear about how we think we are as individuals and working within this costume that we're wearing. So we can eliminate fears by gaining knowledge, by learning a lesson. We've eliminated a fear that we had of something because we see it for what it really is and we understand it. Yes?
If we should choose not to strengthen or purify our feelings, will our current feelings remain the same, or will they get worse?
Well, it would seem if you're going to feed something to make it and nourish something, that could be getting better. But if you just don't do anything about it, it's going to dwindle away and everything is going to go in that lower section, in that lower direction. Not a helping of oneself and a helping in that way of all.
So then with respect to purifying and strengthening the feelings, if we use that analogy of a flower bed is our desires, and there are the higher desires and the lower desires, then the higher desires would be the flowers that we're cultivating, and the beauty of them is assimilated into our permanent being. But then there's the weeds. And so it's a matter of, you know, in the simplest of terms, purify the desires simply as pull the weeds. Strengthening is providing the right fertilizer. So it would seem probably to be wise to pull the weeds before we add fertilizer. And so how does that really translate into the human nature? Like how does one pull weeds out of this character? And what would the fertilizer of our desires to strengthen our desires?
We would think the fertilizer to strengthen our desire would be for something that is everlasting within us. Something that can go through situations and go through lessons to the point where we would not be needing lessons, where we would not be needing a demonstration of certain things to be learned because we have learned them. And we have learned to be in harmony and balance with everything. And the idea that if it can happen to one, it can happen to all, which comes back to that idea of desire. Where do you want to put your energy and force? On your woes, on your pile of weeds that are constantly coming back? Or do you want to put your energy on this flower bed that can bloom without any bugs, without any disease, but just be the beauty that it is with its own colors and scents and enjoyment that it can give to all? If you start to make yourself a list and we look at the idea of strength being, it's also a power of resistance that we can pull from ourselves. We can learn to resist that which is of a selfish, lower nature. We can rely on that as a reliance. Yes?
We've seen some very beautiful weeds in our life, ones that we wouldn't necessarily want to pull out. The destructive or the unpleasant part of a weed is it gets in the way of what you want to produce, whether it's food or beautiful flowers. So in a sense, the weeds we have to pull out of our nature, the feelings, are the ones that get in the way of the spiritual progress we want to make. We don't usually pull out weeds if we see them self-serving. We nourish them.
That is very, very true when you say it in that extent, to understand. Everything has its time and place in nature, but we can't really say that about human nature because we're a little confused on what is human nature. Yes?
Just a note of warning. HPB says in the key that the attention to the garden should be in helping others, and that if we seek to plant something beautiful for someone else, it eliminates weeds from our own garden. So yes, we have to be responsible for our garden, but our focus shouldn't be there. We shouldn't have the world's most beautiful garden. We should be a wonderful gardener to everyone else.
A teacher, a lender. So are we not working on that ability to gain as much of the knowledge that we could tap through different methods, meditation for one, that we could tap, which we really have within us, which is that Buddhi quality that was spoken of, that storehouse or warehouse of all past knowledge we have gained. It moves with us from life to life. And hopefully in some lifetime, we will put enough attention to wanting to know that, to wanting to know how to express it, that in some lifetime, and it would seem it's not an overnight situation. It's a lifetime of working in a certain direction. Yes, do you have a point?
How do you deal with people who deny their feelings? If you have people in your life who say, yeah, I know I have feelings, but I don't pay attention to them.
Well, would it be of a negative atmosphere, or would it be of a positive attitude, but they're not checking it either way? Is that possible?
As a result, they also sort of poo-poo those people who rely on and act only on their feelings, and then the other extreme. But there are people like that.
We're sure there are, yes.
Well, perhaps they haven't developed the ability to look themselves in the eye, which is difficult. When we start this and dredge up all our negative habits, it's pretty ugly. And perhaps people don't want to do that. Yeah. But real quickly, earlier it was said February 14th was a meeting about something. It's actually March.
No, Valentine's Day.
Yes.
See, and there's something right there. There's some of us that are go all out. There are others, it's just another day. You know, if anything, put that smile on your face. Walk down that street. Give out that hand. But show it as best you can express it. It's gotten to be very commercial. Yes.
Perhaps the problem with the person who doesn't acknowledge their feelings is they have a different understanding of what feelings are than you do. There's a book out, What Do You Mean When You Say God? And when you think about it, that's a very powerful question, because different people have different concepts of what they think God is. Different people have different concepts of what they think feelings are. And can I add one thing to this? And that is, in the construction that those of us who believe in reincarnation are trying to build of ourselves, feelings is the best tool, better than thought. Thought requires analyzing and interpretation. Feelings are direct. All it requires is that you recognize. Once you recognize, you don't have to analyze it. You don't have to interpret it. It is immediate, and it is the best tool for building what we're trying to build.
And it's a tool that has to be used all the time, not just in one direction or another, but in practically everything we do. We do have feelings of how we're going to do them and how we're going to express them and what it'll bring to us to give out. Yes.
We remember hearing a wonderful phrase, change the thought and the feeling will follow. So in that sense, the thought is the ruling idea. The feeling is the effect. And if we change the wrong thought, the feeling has to follow, has to change.
It would seem it would make perfect sense in that condition. It's really interesting. When we speak about duty, what is our duty? And we always think, it always tells us that's what is due to all humanity. The duty. The duty that lies in front of you is that which is due to all humanity. It gives it a larger sense of understanding. Anything that comes directly to us is something we must act on, disregarding, in a way, the situation, but rather our feelings towards it. It means we have to act on it. For some look the other way, it doesn't exist. For others, they go powering right into it. Some might stagger along, but there are a lot of hints that give us a help of how we can do this. It's like keeping a daily journal of one's life. It can help us to make certain type decisions and how we make them. And we understand you can't have progress without change. So that should be another thing for us to understand. We're going to have to change our way of thinking about life in general, in our situation, and where we fit in this whole situation. Yes.
I think last week, last Sunday, if we want to purify our feelings, you're given a tool of reflection, and that as a self-conscious being, we have that ability to reflect on our life and on ourselves. So to do this, one must learn to concentrate, and then one must meditate. And meditation is really becoming one with that unchanging aspect, that eternal aspect that dwells within each and every one of us. So by making that a part of our life, that will purify our feelings, because we realize that we are not temporary in that sense, but we are eternal beings.
And it is a great tool that we should all try to delve into. We would like to just mention two things. One of Robert Crosby, and also William Q. Judd, I said, and HPB. So let's say three things real quick. Every mean and selfish action sends us backwards, not forward, while every noble thought and every unselfish deed are the stepping stones to a higher and more glorious planes of being. That's from HPB. And from Robert Crosby, looking at life from this point of view, everything that comes is an opportunity to be taken advantage of by that spiritual man. And in everything we find that glorious, unsought fight, which only fortune's favorite soldiers may obtain. We are that. And then from Mr. Judge, which was just what it said, we must be ready to say at any moment, under whatever circumstances, whether expected or unexpected situations, it is just what I, in fact, desire. That higher part of our nature that is already of strength and purification. Class adjourned. It's okay.